Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to remind everyone next week is our last TMR session for the spring. We will be back in the fall. And next week we'll be hosting Jason Helgerson, who is the Medicaid director for New York State. Mr. Helgerson is joining us through the invitation of Marilyn Pinsky, who each year sponsors a TMR session in memory of her husband, Philip. So hopefully you'll be here and can join us for the last TMR session. It'll be a good one, I think. So today we have with us, thankfully, Greg Tripoli, who grew up and went to school in Central New York. He and I were just talking about being natives of Syracuse in Central New York. Upon graduation from Liverpool High School, he attended Hamilton College and received a BA before receiving an MBA from Katz Graduate School of Business at the University of Pittsburgh. He began his professional career in banking and spent 25 years in the field of management, consulting, working and living in the Middle East, Europe, North America, Great Britain, South America, Canada, the U.S., and the Caribbean. I wouldn't have come back from the Caribbean. As the executive director of Onondaga Historical Association, he is responsible for the strategic planning, fiscal management, and day-to-day operations. Please help me welcome Greg Tripoli.
Thank you, and good morning. So today, actually, I'm going to talk about two of my favorite topics, women and philanthropy. So first, I'm going to give you a little bit of background on, in general, set the stage for women and philanthropy in the U.S., and then we'll get to zero in on some local women who really changed the world that we live in today. And women have a long history of philanthropy in Syracuse and Central New York. They saw a need and encouraged others, took upon themselves great societal challenges to help their neighbors cope and thrive, and to make their communities better places to live. Over the years, philanthropy in general has been shaped by the culture and the social norms of the time in which it took place. Of course, it was further influenced by the experiences of the individual philanthropist. Historian Nancy Hewitt said that in general, particular philanthropic ventures are shaped by gender, racial, ethnic, and class relations rooted in structures of social, political, and economic power. And this is especially true for the female philanthropists of the 19th and early 20th centuries. It was a progressive era that witnessed a great change in the role of women in society and how that role influenced their philanthropy as society evolved and as women gained more rights and more self-consciousness. During that progression, though, there is no mistaking that some of the female philanthropy of the 19th century would today be considered elitist and morally authoritarian, and in many cases even misguided. Historically, women were the primary institution builders for philanthropic causes, and for the most part, these institutions arose from seriously altruistic intentions. But in the context of the local culture and social norms of the time, there were certain segments of the population that were minimized or even adversely affected. For example, although Central New York was a hotbed of abolitionist activity, philanthropy to benefit minority populations is conspicuous by its absence from the great majority of organized philanthropic societies and associations in the 19th century, which were usually started by white, middle, and upper-class women. These were concerted efforts to benefit Native Americans, but this generally involved efforts to purge them of their native traditions by any means necessary in order to absorb them into the mainstream of white American Christian culture. In the 19th century, one of the great minority classes, of course, consisted of women themselves. Let's face it, it was a man's world, and women on the whole were subordinate to men. For some women of the 19th century, philanthropy, and particularly financial philanthropy, gave them the ability to compensate for their own frustrations about being insubordinate to men by participating in the subordination of others and even other women. The New York Women's Hospital, for example, which was founded and funded by women and even had a board of lady managers, was involved in practices that are seriously upsetting today to feminists and humanitarians. The historian and women's studies specialist Ruth Crocker states that white women's rights sometimes rested historically on the immiseration of other women. What is most important to acknowledge and remember, however, is that the vast majority of truly charitable and humanitarian organizations in existence in our community today that benefit all mankind would never have begun at all without the women of the 19th century. Though these organizations, their methods, and their beneficiaries have changed with the times, it was women who, without access to capital, took it upon themselves to do what they could to benefit others. From the early years of Syracuse and central New York, as in the rest of the country, female philanthropy centered on volunteer associations, which were started by women, mostly religious women. These associations were carried on from private homes or church basements, far from the plush offices and boardrooms of their male counterparts. These volunteers were involved in creating infrastructure that eventually led to institution building. Many of our charitable organizations in existence today, from the Rescue Mission to the Syracuse Home Association, were started by these women and their volunteer associations. Volunteering was a particularly proper and acceptable activity for the 19th century woman, and for the elite classes, it was expected. The perception of women as more kind-hearted, compassionate, benevolent, and giving than men made the sacrifice of self or substance especially appropriate and was, in fact, considered by Crocker as the essence of Christian womanliness. In the 19th century, charitable activity and volunteer associations also allowed women to have a more extensive public and social life, to get out of the house, and in a way overcome some of the legal and social barriers that the time would have otherwise imposed. There is, of course, another very good reason why female philanthropy was rooted almost entirely in volunteerism. Women just did not have access to money. By 1860, women constituted only 5.6% of wealth holders in the U.S. At the time, our culture's comfort level with the relationship between females and finance was precarious at best. In general, women who worked, invested, or speculated for the purpose of accumulating wealth ran the risk of being considered unfeminine or even unnatural. It was plainly unseemly for women to have money. Once the voluntary associations that they started became public institutions, they were inevitably run by men. Wealth accumulation was strictly a man's realm, and although women were certainly allowed to work in some occupations, if they were married or if they lived with their fathers, they were mostly required to hand over their salaries to the man of the house. At the time, the vast majority of women's wealth was a result of inheriting or marrying into fortunes. But for many of these women, this money gave them the ability to take female philanthropy and their causes into a new realm, opening doors to activism and reform, where institutions were not only built by women, but sustained and run by them as well. Of course, in a study of philanthropy, it matters less how you got it than what you did with it. At first, women often gave to their husbands' causes or to memorialize their fathers, in addition to their own spheres of influence, usually to benefit children, the sick, and the elderly. Eventually, more individual, esoteric beneficiaries appeared, such as the arts and culture. Education was a popular beneficiary, though again, at first, there were the schools of husbands and fathers, or big-name schools, none of which accepted females, that provided a certain air of prestige and renown for the donor, which gave them a sense of power and authority that they, of course, had been denied. As time went on, female philanthropists became more concerned with women's issues, such as education for women, suffrage, the right to vote, the ability to control their own resources, and equality. As we move further into the 20th century, minority causes and organizations with a wider geographic scope, like national or international relief agencies, became more prevalent. We'll see these trends, actually, as we take a closer look and highlight a few of the individual female philanthropists from our local history to show how their lives and times influenced their giving and what impact their particular philanthropy had on our community. Most of these women had a long history of volunteer activity during their lifetimes, but the historical record of their financial philanthropy deals mainly with the distribution of their estates as directed by their last will and testaments. Margaret Treadwell Redfield Smith. Margaret was an educated woman, a graduate of the Troy Female Seminary, later known as the Emma Willard School, named after its famous headmistress. She shared with her husband, William Smith, a railroad executive, a keen interest in the collection of shells, minerals, botanical specimens, and together they were able to amass a serious collection of shells during their lives. She was an accomplished writer, authored a highly acclaimed book entitled Zoological Science or Nature in Living Forms. Margaret came from a prominent family, which owed their status to her father, Lewis Hamilton Redfield, who was a pioneer printer and publisher of the Onondaga Register here in Onondaga County. Her mother was extremely accomplished. She was a teacher, a writer, a scientist. She was really the equivalent of the superintendent of schools here in Onondaga County at the time. Margaret was old enough to remember many of the milestones in early history of our community and consequently became one of our early unofficial historians and was one of the charter members of OHA. She inherited a portion of her husband's sizable estate, and she became a regular donor to local charities. He also left her the life use of their mansion on Irving Avenue. Though the house could not be made a part of her estate, because upon her death, it went to her husband's residuary legatees. As a witness to the ravages of the Civil War, she was one of the earliest and largest contributors to the establishment of the Soldiers and Sailors Monument in Clinton Square, which was originally intended as a monument to the Civil War soldiers. The bulk of her fortune, however, about $30,000, which is equivalent to about $730,000 today, which she gave during her lifetime, went to the erection of a memorial to her father. The statue of Lewis Redfield, which still stands in Foreman Park. As a result of this memorial, actually, Margaret's estate at the time of her death consisted of only about $5,000 worth of personal property, mostly her shell collection and the mementos or the contents of her home. The shells went to the Syracuse City School District, and the contents were divided between relatives and her, with her rare book collection and a good portion of her exceptional antique mahogany furniture coming to OHA. We also received a piece of her and William's 50th wedding anniversary cake from 1896, which is one of the more unusual and petrified artifacts in the collection at OHA. Mary Elizabeth Weeding Johnson. Mary's interests were centered on the advancement of education and drama. She was a lecturer, a poet, and she was married to Dr. John Weeding, who built the Weeding Block on the southern edge of Clinton Square, the largest portion of which was the Weeding Opera House, a theater that played host to many lectures and theater productions of the day. During Dr. Weeding's lifetime, the Weeding Block burned down twice in 1856 and again in 1881 and was twice rebuilt. Upon his death in 1887, his will, which included bequests to many local charities, was declared completely invalid due to a technicality, and Mary therefore inherited his entire estate. She became a businesswoman by retaining and managing the Weeding Block. In the early 1890s, she took a chance on the 16-year-old Sam Schubert and hired him as the treasurer of the theater, providing him with the financial experience and the theater world connections that helped him eventually launch the largest theatrical empire the world has ever known. In 1896, the theater burned down for a third time, and Mary rebuilt it again, making it bigger and better and turning it into the number one theater in Syracuse. In 1900, she married a man named Melville Augustus Johnson and moved out of state. Mr. Johnson preceded her in death by several years, at which point she moved back to Syracuse. Upon her death in 1927, Mary made good on the declared invalid bequests of her first husband, John, thus honoring his wishes to provide $5,000 each to St. Joseph's Hospital, OHA, and the Syracuse Home Association, as well as his desire to provide funds for the addition to the Onondaga Orphans Home in the form of a hospital to benefit women and children under the age of 18. Mary allotted about $100,000 to $125,000 for this project, naming it the Weeding Johnson Memorial Hospital. She also added a $5,000 bequest to Krause Hospital and an additional $50,000 to John's original Syracuse home bequest in order to expand that building. The residue of her estate went to Syracuse University as per John's wishes. So basically, although she had been living away from Syracuse for almost 20 years, and though the bulk of Mary's estate was earned by her in the 40 years since John's death, her entire estate, with the exception of the additional $5,000 to Krause Hospital, went to her first husband's designated beneficiaries. It is entirely possible that these were her choice of beneficiaries as well, and in the end, they were all worthy causes. Does it really matter who chose them? After all, it was Mary's money to give, and it was certainly well given. An interesting note about Mary's will was her specific instructions that the fire insurance on all her real estate be kept up to date until it was sold. There's no doubt that Helen Everson was an art lover. She was a generous supporter of the Syracuse Museum of Fine Art along with her brother Charles. It was actually Charles who first proposed the founding of an Everson Museum. He was an architect and he was a partner in his and Helen's father's hardware business. Charles was the only heir to their father's estate, not uncommon, and it was his responsibility, of course, to take care of his sister and any other women in the family. Charles was the heir, and it was his will, actually, that provided for the founding of a museum if his sister, who was his primary beneficiary, failed to survive him. Charles died in 1925 and left Helen $900,000. That's the equivalent today of about $11 million. Helen made her will in 1927 and always had every intention of carrying out the wishes of her and her brother. In order to conserve her estate for a museum, Helen lived strictly within an income derived from stocks. The wording of her will is important because it led to legal and logistical entanglements that consumed approximately 28 years. Her will stated that after $31,000 in bequests to family and friends and employees, including $7,500 to Memorial Hospital and $1,000 to Plymouth Church, the rest of her estate, amounting to $1 million, equivalent today of about $14.6 million, was to be left to First Trust and Deposit Company as executors for the purpose of founding, erecting, and maintaining a museum of art to be known as the Everson Museum of Art, to be located in the city of Syracuse, New York. Said trustees may also, in their discretion, transfer and turn over the property and trust funds coming into their hands as such trustees to any corporation or association organized for a like purpose, on such conditions as said trustees deem proper, provided such trustees are assured that the purpose for which such corporation or association is organized is substantially the same as herein intended. Now, I underlined the words here to emphasize the parts of Helen's will that resulted in challenges from her will. First, from no fewer than 27 cousins, most of whom she never met in her life, who said that the word may was vague. And then challenges by the Syracuse Museum of Fine Art and Syracuse University. Independently, they claimed that they were the entities already organized for Helen's intended purpose. Two Court of Appeals decisions upheld Helen's will against all challenges and thus began a new dispute over where the new museum would be built. In those Court of Appeals transcripts, Helen specifically, and her friends and family remarked that she was not fond of the Syracuse Museum of Foreign Arts or Syracuse University. And so that's how they declared that neither of those were, in fact, the organizations that were already in place that would be allowed to take that money. In 1959, after years of negotiation, the Everson Corporation finally merged with the Museum of Fine Arts. The total of Helen's estate contributed to that combined organization 28 years after her death amounted only to $1,009,000, only $9,000 more than her original bequest 28 years earlier, showing the financial toll of years of litigation. Perhaps worse than losing the additional funds that were invested, that the invested money could have earned over that period, $1 million had half the purchasing power in 1959 than it did in the year of her death, 1941. So the value of her philanthropic donation actually decreased by 50%. The landmark I.M. Pei building, which now houses the Everson Museum, was finally opened in 1968. And it's a stunning tribute to the philanthropy of Helen Everson, and is a building of which I'm sure Helen would be proud. Rosamond Gifford was definitely an enigma. Her attorney father, William, and her mother separated when Rosamond was just a child, and she lived for the most part with her mother and Tully. She attended a boarding school in Boston, where she supposedly lived under the assumed name of Violet Lavigne, and married an abusive, womanizing, alcoholic gambler in 1895 when she was only 22, who went by the name of Alfred Lafayette, also not his real name. They divorced 5 years later, and she retained her maiden name and returned to Tully. In 1904, when she was 31, her father suggested that she return to Boston and study music, which was a passion of hers, in hopes that she could earn a living at it and become self-sufficient. She did so, and she studied the concert harp until she became proficient enough to be giving lessons. She lived frugally on rent that from some of the property that her mother had given her, and an income from 100 shares of Goodrich rubber stock her father had given her, and of course, on the income from the harp lessons that she gave. After her mother died in 1912, she returned to Tully to settle the estate, and at her father's urging, she sold her mother's house and moved in with her father on a large farm he owned in what is now the area of DeWitt. She did that based on an agreement that she came to with her father that I'll talk about in a minute, but to understand Rosamond, really, it's important to know a bit about her father, as the apple, as we know, very rarely falls far from the tree. He spent most of his time and energy building his financial estate. And though he had plenty of money, he lived rather simply and often felt guilty about his one pleasure, raising trotting horses, because they didn't make him any money. In fact, in his letters to Rosamond, while trying to convince her to move to the farm, he expressed his concern over her ability to make any real money by giving harp lessons, likening her love of music to his love of trotters, referring to such activity as, quote, chasing shadows. His motto was, live like a hermit and work like a horse. He was also constantly worried about how his legacy would be maintained, and once wrote to her about a friend of his who had worked hard and left a fortune that was then squandered by his heirs. William enticed Rosamond to move to the farm with a contract that he put in writing on May 31st, 1913, promising that if she took care of the farm and managed it for him, he would leave her his entire estate when he died. She agreed, and William retired to a home he kept in Syracuse, where he suffered a debilitating stroke a few months later. By all accounts, Rosamond kept her end of the bargain. She was a hard worker and an excellent manager. She began to live by her father's motto, living like a hermit and working like a horse, and the farm flourished. Unbeknownst to her, however, her father, 2 years after his agreement with Rosamond, drew up a will that essentially changed the terms of their 1913 agreement. Instead of giving her his entire estate, he set up a trust that would provide an income of $60,000 a year for 10 years, after which she would receive the entire estate. Rosamond found out about the will when her father died in 1917, and she sued the trust and its executors and won, inheriting just over $1 million, roughly the equivalent today of $16.7 million. Rosamond worked the farm until 1929, when she divided the property into tracts and sold the land, part of which is now occupied by Le Moyne College. She moved to a large house with a barn. She moved to a large house with a barn on the shores of Oneida Lake and lived a very isolated life there, though she kept in close contact with her lawyer and her banker, visiting them once a week in her truck driven by a caretaker. One news report from the time recounts that her standard dress for these outings was a leopard skin coat and riding boots. Rosamond was a tough, no-nonsense woman, and there's no doubt about that. She fought a few high-profile court battles in her lifetime over money, and she was just as protective of her nest egg as her father was about his. In this photo, we see her and her attorney at the courthouse during a break in one of those battles. She hated the IRS, known as the Internal Revenue Bureau, and she often wrote her tax payment checks to the Infernal Revenue Bureau. By the time of her death, which was, incidentally, ironically, on April 15th, tax day, in 1953, she turned the $1 million that her father took a lifetime to build into an estate worth $66 million, the equivalent today of just over $48 million. And she gave almost every penny of it to establish a charitable corporation. The large home she lived in was very sparsely furnished, and her bedroom was the only furnished room on the second floor. I think she had a bed, a dresser, and a shotgun. Her executors actually had to borrow her borrow chairs to hold her very small funeral in the home. The barn on the estate contained 33 goats, whose milk was used to feed her over 50 cats, and Rosamond herself, who was a great proponent of goat's milk. We have no record of Rosamond's involvement or contributions to any charities while she was alive. I came across one newspaper article that mentioned she gave anonymously, and of course, that's possible, though we do know that, like her father, she was fiercely committed to wealth accumulation. Her will does not specify any particular organization or field of interest, stating that the corporation should benefit, quote, religious, educational, scientific, charitable, or benevolent causes. Did Rosamond give her money to charity in order to keep it out of the hands of the IRS? One can only guess. What we do know, however, is that the Gifford Foundation has been tremendous stewards of her money and has benefited countless organizations and worthy causes. Both William and Rosamond Gifford would be very pleased to know that their nest eggs were certainly not squandered, and Rosamond would be particularly pleased to know that not one penny went to the Infernal Revenue Bureau. And now we come to the grand dame of female philanthropists of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Margaret Olivia Slocum Sage. Olivia, as she preferred to be called, was a child of privilege. Very smart, fun, vivacious, well-liked, socially conscious. Her father was a bad businessman, though, and lost their fortune in bad business deals by the time she was in her early teens. He spent the rest of his life trying to recoup those losses, but was never really able to. Thanks to sponsorship from her uncle, Olivia was educated at the Troy Female Seminary, where Emma Willard became Olivia's greatest mentor. Eventually, the family became virtually homeless. Her mother went to live with a rich brother in his mansion, and the family kind of dispersed. Her brother enlisted in the army, and Olivia became a teacher to support herself. Here we see Olivia as a teacher on the far left at the St. Paul's Female School in Syracuse. As she moved from teaching job, she was always involved in voluntary work and always gave a portion of her small salary to charity. She made about $200 a year as a teacher. And though she made very little money, she traveled in prominent circles with the social contacts that she made as a young girl with the rest of her family. As a working woman, she experienced the difficulties common to all working women of the 19th century. At times, she worked as a governess, teacher, guest in the homes of some of Syracuse's wealthiest families. The long streets of Yates Castle, which we see here, the Leavenworths, the Barnes home on James Street. These positions embodied a very ironic combination of a working professional woman within a domestic setting, combining wage-earning independence with domesticity, emblematic of her life in a way, where she was a progressive advocate yet within the confines of acceptable 19th century restrictions and limitations. Her work with voluntary associations often challenged the status quo of male dominance and dealt heavily with the education of women and women's advancement into paid work and professions. Yet she was also very conscious of the proper role of women in society. Later, when women were allowed to attend certain colleges, her philanthropy was geared toward protecting the morals and the standards of conduct of female undergraduates, where she advocated a conservative, paternalistic environment that protected girls from dancing, drinking, smoking, and, of course, boys, except in a strictly academic setting. She declined a few marriage proposals in her life because she felt that they were not to her advantage and were too restricting. Olivia was not the kind of woman who would be satisfied with domestic life on the farm. Though she had no money, she had lots of rich friends and very expensive tastes. Finally, in 1869, at 41 years of age, she became the second wife of the widowed Russell Sage, one of the richest men in America. Unfortunately for Olivia, he was also a terrible miser. She became a tireless volunteer, supporting a wide range of causes from animal protection to social work, but she could rarely get Russell to part with more than token financial assistance for her causes. She was barely able to eke out like small donations from him, usually about $25 to $100 at best. At the time, in an interview for a Syracuse newspaper, Olivia was quoted as saying that the most frequent cause of unhappy marriages was, quote, the absence of individual incomes. In 1905, Olivia wrote an essay entitled Opportunities and Responsibilities of the Leisured Woman, in which she wrote that, quote, woman is responsible in proportion to the wealth and time at her command. While one woman is working for bread and butter, the other must devote her time to the amelioration of her laboring sister. In 1906, Russell died, leaving almost $75 million, close today to about $2 billion, to Olivia. And she then began one of the most aggressive philanthropic binges in American history. And there's scarcely an organization or educational institution in Syracuse that did not benefit greatly from her largesse, including her purchase of the Yates Castle, where she once worked as a teacher for the Longstreet children, as the home for a new teacher's college for Syracuse University. It's impossible to even begin to name the countless beneficiaries of her gifts, but you'll have some idea when I tell you that in the remaining 12 years of her life, she gave away over $45 million, close to $1 billion today. She received over 300 begging letters per day and hired an entire staff to sort through the requests. She was a careful and conservative benefactor who believed in serious investigation of potential beneficiaries and only gave to those who showed an inclination and motivation to help themselves. By 1907, when she became the nation's largest individual taxpayer, her support for women's suffrage and representation took on an understandably greater urgency. And she realized she was the largest individual taxpayer in the country, and she had absolutely no say in how that money was being spent because, of course, women did not have the vote. Olivia was still, however, a woman of her times, and she named many of her gifts after her husband and the other men in her family, including the Russell Sage Foundation, which she founded with an initial gift of $10 million. Even the College for Women that she founded was given the name Russell Sage. And many believe that her motive in these regards, including her many gifts to prestigious universities, regardless of their attitude towards accepting and educating women, was her attempt to salvage Russell's reputation, which was less than stellar on several accounts. Although Olivia had the best intentions, some of her gifts also demonstrate the misguided elitist attitudes of the day, as she was one of those lady managers of the New York Women's Hospital and was a large benefactor of the Carlisle School, which tried to purge Native Americans of their rich heritage. And here we see a photo of some of the Indian children, sort of a before and after, if you will, of the Carlisle School. She was very generous to her family as well, though she was a woman of principle and was not afraid to say no even to them. One of her great nephews once wrote to her saying, "Please send money. I'm one jump ahead of the sheriff." Olivia's two-word reply was short: "Keep jumping." She managed her own investments, which was very unusual at the time, and she was able in 12 short years to turn her $75 million inheritance into almost $100 million. Her Syracuse roots proved beneficial to the Schubert brothers, who provided an excellent return on her investment in them as she helped fund their New York City expansion, and together with other Syracuse investors helped them build Broadway as we know it today. Her estate at the time of her death consisted of almost $50 million, almost all of which went to charity. Her will also demonstrated her personal evolution as she went against conventional trends, as well as her own historical record of giving, and provided generously for two African-American institutions, Tuskegee and Hampton Institutes. She chose to be buried next to her parents at Oakwood Cemetery, as opposed to the Troy, New York Cemetery, where her husband was buried. And the OHA archives contain a very rare and perhaps the only photograph of a funeral in progress at Oakwood from the time capturing the scene at Olivia's graveside. As you know, philanthropy isn't always just about the power of the money purse. The history of many of our beneficial organizations reminds us that they were born of and nurtured by volunteer efforts. There's an argument about whether Sage's philanthropy actually affected major change on a grand scale because her funds were dispersed among so many organizations. I would say that collectively, because her gifts were so large, she did, but probably not in any one particular area, except for perhaps education for women. But the question remains, can anyone affect major change on a grand scale without spending millions or today billions of dollars? The answer to this question comes in my closing, where I'd like to bring us up to date with an all too brief mention of a local female philanthropist who is still amongst us. Through passion, dedication, expertise, and a commitment to addressing one of our world's most pressing problems, Ruth Colvin has effected major change on a grand scale, covering over 62 countries and hundreds of thousands of people to help eradicate illiteracy. As someone who spent a great deal of my adult life living outside of the U.S., much of that time in the Middle East, an area that's seriously misunderstood by the Western world, I completely agree with Ruth's contention that our world would be a much happier and more peaceful place if we knew more about each other's histories, cultures, traditions, and religions. Since most people don't have the ability to physically immerse themselves in other cultures, the next best thing is to read about them. In founding Literacy Volunteers of America, Ruth has helped create a bridge between diverse populations that has resulted in a better world for all of us. The recipient of the President's Volunteer Action Award and the Presidential Medal of Freedom, a member of the National Women's Hall of Fame, Ruth Colvin has taught all of us what can be accomplished when your purse is filled only with passion. Thank you. I'll take questions not only on this topic, but anything that you might want to know about OHA and what we're up to these days?
I have a thought that has nothing to do with the essence, but my question here is, not one of these philanthropists you mentioned had any children, which is supposedly a woman's role.
I think Margaret Treadwell Redfield Smith did have children. they were very accomplished women. There were women who did not, you know, really fit the mold in certain ways. You know, what they did with their money was, of course, very acceptable at the time. And I never thought about that they didn't have they didn't have children.
You don't.
Thank God, or they would have soaked up all of that money, and we wouldn't have gotten any of it, right?
Hey, I was just curious. Has this been what is OHA's relationship with the Syracuse City School District? I think like some of the kids would be fascinated by some of these stories, particularly the plot that was once Lemoyne and the history of the Giffords and stuff like that. What's your guys' relationship with the school district, and how's that going?
We have no relationship whatsoever with the school district. No, we have a great relationship with the Syracuse City School District and all the school districts in Onondaga County. So, gosh, I mean, I don't know where to begin. We did a big project last year where we do a lot of teacher training because teachers in the local school district don't know about our local history. And local history is not included in the curriculum standards that they have. And so we believe that students would be more receptive and they will retain more if they know that the things that they're learning about in state and national and global studies were affected things that happened in their own backyard. And so what we've done is create teachers and administration from the school district have created over 120 packets, right, Dennis, of that are study packets. Where we use local history, and this includes all of the information that they need, a lesson plan, primary, secondary source material. Each one is a packet that corresponds directly to the state curriculum requirements that the teachers have, where we're using local history to help them teach students who will, they're teaching to tests, of course, but this works within that curriculum, so that students do know that. We have a gallery in our downtown museum that is specifically dedicated to the Syracuse City School District, and right now there is an exhibit up that has where students curate their own exhibits on topics that are of interest to them. They use our collections. They're supervised by our curators. And they curate and mount an exhibit. And right now we have an exhibit in that student gallery that was curated by students from Central IT Tech, and that soon will be coming down, and they'll be doing another one. I think their topic is immigration and refugee resettlement for the next. So we work with them often. We do in school programs. They come to our museums. Certainly. The Scano Great Law of Peace Center, which is our facility in Liverpool, has been of great interest to teachers for field trips and students to learn about our Native American history in ways that they're not taught in local schools.
My question goes to what would be the qualifications that you'd lay on that makes for a philanthropist? Obviously, it's not just money. As you just mentioned with Ruth, maybe it was more her intensity and knowledge and commitment to a particular area of some worthwhile project or whatever. What would make for a person to be considered a philanthropist, whether woman or anybody else?
I'm going to look at my friends from the foundations here, but I would say that people who dedicate themselves, not just money but time and passion and persistence to a cause that benefits a wide range of people. Yeah, Heidi, is that pretty accurate?
This is fascinating. I loved your presentation and learned a lot and appreciated the context that you put this in, because like when Sally Roche Wagner came and talked about how women's suffrage got split by the move for equal rights,
Christian
and also
women,
temperance,
yeah, right.
and that sort of thing, that there are trade-offs, and there's some, there's upside and downside to philanthropy. But I'm a real booster of Syracuse, love to brag about the place, and I'd like you to see if you could expand the context a little bit. It sounds like there are a lot of women philanthropists in Syracuse, and You mentioned, it was interesting, I mean, all the constraints that they faced and the expectations, and maybe they were a little bit against the grain in being such leaders in philanthropy. But was Syracuse unusual in this regard, or did most cities our size also have female philanthropists and similar activities? Or were we a little bit like, you know, having the suffragettes in Syracuse and Central New York, were we a little bit ahead or above the rest?
You know, we were typical, as I mentioned before, you know, women who came into money, it was unseemly for them to be, for people to see that they had it. And so they were, a lot of these women were already involved in volunteer associations. That was generally the role of women and at the time. And so not unusual at all that they would give, you know, once they came into money, that they would give to these organizations that they had been volunteering with or helping with. I would say that Syracuse, New York State in general, was much more progressive historically than other states. We were a great hotbed of reform movements, you know, folks that kind of migrated here from the Northeast New England area, where they wanted to expand things like religious reform. Obviously, we had we are the center of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, which was a matrilineal society where women had positions of leadership, and so that was a tremendous motivation and inspiration. It's no surprise then that the women's rights movement began here in Central New York. So we were a hotbed of reform movements in many, many ways, and not the least of those was more independence for women. So I think that we may have been at the forefront as one of the larger cities in a state that was so progressive, but it wasn't totally uncommon from the role of women and women in philanthropy in the rest of the United States at the time.
Would you ever think of partnering with the Irisin Museum and putting one of or having one of your exhibits at the Irisin, which might give it a wider distribution?
Well, we partner with the Irisin pretty much on a regular basis. We've had exhibits that we often loan them. We have a very extensive art collection at OHA because we've been collecting for 154 years. So we often loan things to them for their collections. We have a number of proposals on the table with the Irisin that have been there for a year, a couple years. Yeah, we reach out to them as well as to our other sister organizations in the art and culture industry. We have regular collaborations with a lot of them, the Syracuse Stage. If any of you go there, you see exhibits that we have that where we draw local historical connections to the play or the musical, the production that they're mounting at the time. This adds a lot of value to these partners because for the Syracuse Stage collaboration, for example, these exhibits give people something to do before and after and during intermission. It educates people on interesting tidbits about local history that they may not have known about. And frankly, it adds value in another way because the stage is trying to connect whatever production they have on stage to the audience. The stronger connection that they can make, particularly emotional connection, the greater chance that they will have of having the success of that play. So when people see that things that happen, that they see happening on stage, whether it involves the play or certain characters or the time or themes that happen in their own community, they automatically become more connected to that production. So we always look for ways that we can add value to our partners. We, by the way, don't charge them for any of these. We provide these exhibits to Syracuse Stage free of charge. We find the sponsors, and if we don't find a sponsor, we fund it ourselves. We eat it and provide these. Those exhibits also travel through the Onondaga County Public Library System, where we work with the library to create a reading list. So we're adding value not only to the library's local history department, but also to their literacy mission. They also then go to the Common Council chambers in City Hall, and they become traveling exhibits that we use with partners that we have throughout the county and throughout the year, depending on if they would like, you know, a historical exhibit to add value. But the Everson, we work with, on a regular basis. And in fact, one of the Eversons, I think, head of their education department is working with us and the Syracuse City School District, Kiana, right? Working with us on those exhibits at our student gallery at our museum downtown.
Add this one then to your project,
right.
Your conceivable projects, and that is this very presentation that you made today, have it as an evening presentation.
We love to do those. We're a minimum of $150 for a presentation. So, so the more we can do, the more we like to do. That's for sure. But we generally don't do free anymore, except for this gig.
Greg, two unrelated questions. One is the Krauss Hall. Olivia's named after Olivia's family. Do you know up in the campus
yes.
of Syracuse?
Yes. A lot of things on the Syracuse University campus are, you know, Slocum or Sage.
Okay, very good.
Yeah.
The second question is: tell us about your upcoming medal award of the Onondaga Historical Society.
So we award the medal of the Onondaga Historical Association, which is the highest honor that the OHA can bestow. We have an event coming up at the Hotel Syracuse, which honors our longtime curator of history, Dennis Connors, who will be retiring. It's hard for me to even say. Who will be retiring at the end of this year. Probably, I would say, the most deserving person of this award. Absolutely amazing person, curator, employee, probably best brother, father, son, neighbor, you know, just an amazing guy, and so we're thrilled. Yeah. We're thrilled to award this to Dennis and in a small way recognize the contributions that he's made to our community for so many years, and also to Sean Kirst. And the community has rallied as it should for these two amazing gentlemen who have done so much to contribute to the preservation of local history. And response has been great. So we've just been notified the hotel that we have gone beyond what we can hold in the Persian Terrace. And so I think we have another week and a half or so of tickets. So get your tickets to come and honor these two incredible gentlemen, and because now we'll have plenty of space because they've moved us up to the grand ballroom, which is great. I would also like to mention that we have a few other things coming up. I don't know if any of you have seen our film on the history of Onondaga Lake, our first full-length major documentary. Anybody seen that yet? Okay, yeah, good. Yes, thumbs up. Good film. Okay. So please see that. I know it's showing at the Manlius Art Cinema on April 30th, which is a Sunday at noon, and May 2nd, which is a Tuesday at 6 p.m. We are currently working on our next film, documentary about an amazing guy from our local sports history, someone that nobody knows, that everybody should. And it's one of those things where after you see it, you'll think, my God, why doesn't everybody know about this? We have a number of new collaborations that are coming up. We're working on a new museum in partnership with Norm Swanson and Woodbine Group, the Brewseum, which is a museum in our brewing history as part of a larger facility that will include a new brewery, bottling and canning operation, a large tasting room where people can taste and buy only made in New York State products, along with a German restaurant there. We're working on developing a new museum in our aviation history, which is part of the $35 million renovation of the Syracuse Airport. We're always working on new products in our retail stores. You should definitely check out the Scano Great Law of Peace Center, our new facility in Liverpool, which is spectacular and unique and making news all around the country, as is our new typewriter collaboration with Tom Hanks, which many of you have read in the paper. But OHA is working really hard, and we're very busy, and mostly about bringing history to you where you are, in hopes of getting you interested in our local history, building pride in our community, creating a determination to want to build and leave a legacy that's worthy of our great heritage, and providing the additional knowledge that knowing our history brings when you are charting a brighter future. And when you have pride in place and a determination to want to improve the present and better knowledge about charting a brighter future, you can't help but have a more optimistic perception of our future. And I think that that's something our community needs and something that history can help provide. So thank you very much for your time this morning.